We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com.
It's a tough title today, about the stupidity of atheism. I actually wanted to call it that atheists are stupid, but my friend suggested that that wasn't particularly polite. And so I wouldn't want to be impolite, just the stupidity of atheism. And agnostics are cowards, or the cowardice of agnosticism. I'm not saying that they're unintelligent, just that the activity of atheism is stupid. Now why? Well, there is a continuum, if you like to put it, between belief in the existence of God and belief in the non-existence of God, in which agnosticism is in the middle, and in which many people are sitting in that middle agnostic position. Now, I wish to suggest to you that atheism is a very attractive alternative to people who are agnostics. It's a great attraction, a magnetic attraction for people. And I want to suggest to the agnostics amongst us here the great danger of coming towards atheism, the danger of coming into a stupidity. And so what I want to do is pick on atheism itself. Now, it's an odd thing to do because there's hardly any atheists in the world. And there's very few atheists here in this lecture room. Some of you will immediately protest and say, oh no, I want to be an atheist, but hang on, watch out, because I'm just about to say that atheism is stupid, so you need to be careful before you identify yourself too quickly, lest you find out where you are. You see, an atheist believes that God does not exist. That is, he believes a negative. Believing negatives are very difficult positions to be in, isn't it? Because you've got to be absolutely omnicompetent in the area of knowledge. You've got to know everything to know that something doesn't exist. You can only know that pink elephants with wheels do not exist by knowing everything. If you don't know everything, then it's possible that pink elephants with wheels exist in the area of your ignorance, isn't it? To claim that you know that something does not exist requires you to know everything. Very few people wish to say that. And so, in the 19th century, when atheism was all the vogue, we have Mr. Huxley coming up with a new word of agnosticism to describe his position. Now, agnosticism comes to us in two forms, hard form and soft form. The hard form of agnosticism is to say that the knowledge of God is unknowable. You cannot know. It is impossible to know whether God exists or not. That's the hard form of agnosticism. The soft form of agnosticism is to say, I don't know whether God exists or not. I may be able to find out if there's more information, more investigation, more inquiry. It's possible that I'll be persuaded to believe that God exists. It's possibly I'll be dissuaded from believing God exists. But at the moment, I do not know. Hard, I cannot know. Soft, I do not know. Now, of course, the hard agnostic is in exactly the same problem as the atheist. He's a man who wants to know a negative. He wants to know that you cannot know. Now, you can't actually come to that position until you know everything. He doesn't know everything, but he still wants to hold. It's actually a cowardly way of being an atheist. That's all it is. The soft agnostic, well, that's many of you may be. I don't know. But that is the attractive position to be in. You see, belief in God requires you ultimately to commit your life to God. You can hardly believe that there is someone who owns you, rules you, and who's going to call you to account on the last day, and at the same time ignore him totally. Of course, that's what the vast majority of Australians do, but you really, that's a fairly stupid position to be in. So therefore, it is very attractive to say he's not there. However, you can't know he's not there because you can't know a negative. So you want to say, well, you can't know that God is not there, but that still puts you in the same position. You say, I don't know. And atheism has got a tremendous attraction to you. So you want to go that way because you don't want God. Now, I'm going to suggest to you six interrelated reasons why atheism is stupid. They're interrelated, and then have a challenge to you as to what to do about it, because I'm not actually here just to philosophise, and I'm not here really just to titillate imaginations of people who have got more than they know what to do with. I'm here to actually challenge you to make change, and so I'll come to that at the end. But firstly, six interrelated reasons as to why I view atheism as stupid. The first one is because of hypocrisy. That is, it poses to be non-emotional, rational, empirical, scientific, neutrally unbiased evaluation of the facts. Not going beyond the facts like a dogmatic Christian would. Tut, tut, shame, shame. But someone who really just thinks and only bases what he believes on what is plainly observable, empirically observable, rationally defensible, etc. Now, of course, you don't need Marx and Freud to know that such a position is an absolute stupidity. No one is unbiased, neutral like that. Doesn't exist. Never has. There's the great two errors about bias. One is to deny it, and the other is to think that it is determinative. You see, I am biased like everybody here in this room is biased. I'm a Christian, and I view the world as a Christian, and I view the evidences of the world from a Christian viewpoint. The atheist views the world from an atheistic viewpoint, from the viewpoint that God doesn't exist and therefore takes all the evidence into account from that viewpoint. And the agnostic frequently does it from the cynical viewpoint. The cynical viewpoint which makes sure that he will never know anything. We all are biased. But having said that, you see, some people want now to defend themselves, race to the other end and say, and therefore you can never make up your mind about anything because you're just biased. You see, I can't know one way or another. I'm just stuck with my bias, which of course is absolute nonsense, isn't it? For we change our minds. There was a time when wasn't a Christian, and now is there a time I am a Christian. I've changed my mind. Your biases are not determinative like that. The whole exercise of our discussion, of our thinking, of coming and of reasoning together has got to do with the idea that we will be able to change our minds, that we are not actually determined to the extent that you have no freedom to say, I used to think this and now I think that, and acting upon it. We are biased, yes. And the atheist, though, in the posture he takes of an intellectual stance, is really a terrible hypocrisy. It's not like that. You say, here's a book. I'll refer to it a couple of times, by a man called Monod, if you're an Australian, and I don't know how you pronounce it if you're a Frenchman. But I'm sure it's not Monod. He's a biochemist, a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And the flyleaf is very clever, you see, because it describes this great atheist writer using the unrelenting logic of a scientist. He draws upon what we know of genetic structure. Unrelenting logic of a scientist. He's not human. That's a nonsense, isn't it? And when you read the book, you'll see it's even more of a nonsense. We're all caught in bias. Sir Kenneth Clarke was a great art critic. Made a great film series and came on the ABC. It was a BBC series on art. An atheist. And he writes in his autobiography, I had a religious experience. It took place in the Church of San Lorenzo, but it didn't seem to be connected with the harmonious beauty of the architecture. I can only say that for a few minutes my whole being was irradiated by a kind of heavenly joy, far more intense than anything I had ever known before. And this state of mind lasted several months. And wonderful though it was, it posed an awkward problem in terms of my actions. My life was far from blameless. I would have to reform. My family would think I was going mad. And perhaps, after all, it was a delusion, for I was in every way unworthy of receiving such a flood of grace. Gradually the effect wore off. I made no effort to retain it. I think I was right. I was too deeply embedded in the world to change course. But that I had felt the finger of God, I am quite sure. And although the memory of this experience has faded, it still helps me understand the joy of the saints. An incredible statement. You see, the experience was such as to leave him completely convinced that God was there. But reason why he didn't do anything about it? Moral reform would be required. His family would think he was mad. Stupidity of atheism, it poses intellectual, but in fact it's a moral choice. Second reason is because the Bible says so. It's a good reason. Inside the white sheet you have that is given out, and it will be given out different days, different colours I think, the first of the quotations from the Bible. I've got a series of Bible verses I'll use each day, show you that I'm talking from the Bible's perspective. The first one, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, their deeds are evil, there is no one who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven on the sons of men to see if any there are who understand, any who seek God, and all have turned aside, they have together become corrupt. There is no one who does good, not even one. The psalmist, you see, is under no misunderstanding about an intellectually neutral man making his decision about God. The psalmist perceives that it's a spiritual moral business. In his heart, the man of evil always wants to say there is no God, because he wants to run life his own way, doing his own thing. He doesn't want life where there is responsibility, where there is punishment, where he's going to be held accountable, where he's going to be told what to do by somebody else. He doesn't want a life where there is destiny written out already, or duty to be performed. The last sentence of this book says exactly the same thing. The last sentence, or the last two sentences: man at last knows that he's alone in this unfeeling immensity of the universe, out of which he emerged only by chance. Neither his destiny nor his duty have been written down. Here's the great love of the atheist: the idea of being free to do my own thing. And so the best way of doing that is to say God is not there. That's the easiest way, because once you say God is there, I'm not free to do my own thing anymore. And so the fool says in his heart, there is no God. If I can just close my eyes, he can't see me. That's the great principle. I was at the University of New South Wales a couple of weeks ago, speaking with people there, and you can understand that stupidity is a matter that will come out fairly clearly there, but the atheists... Well, it was with a group of social work students. So... There I had a couple of very interesting conversations, and I mentioned to people they're going to be held accountable by God before at the end of the world. And they said to me, you mustn't talk like that, scare tactics, you're trying to scare us about hell. Right? And that's immoral. A very interesting idea, I said. It's like the Botany Council. You must go and write a complaint to the Botany Council, because they've got those huge signs up down by Botany Bay saying, beware, sharks, danger, don't swim. Now that's scare tactics, isn't it? It's immoral. You must write and oppose that kind of thing. It's a dreadful thing. There's somebody out swimming, enjoying his last swim just before lunch. And no longer can he relax and enjoy himself because he's got this terrible knot in his stomach about the anxiety of the sharks. Now if he didn't put up the shark sign, he would enjoy himself and the shark wouldn't have knotted me to eat at the middle of the lunch, you see? Scare tactics. And they said, but that's different. That's different, you see, because the sharks are there. I said, really, the sharks are there and hell's not. And they say, no. I said, how do you know? And they said, because we don't believe in it. And I said, well, it doesn't scare you. And they said, no, there's no point using it. It's not a scare tactic at all, because it doesn't scare us. Now, I'm getting a little confused this stage. I said, why doesn't it scare you? They say, because it's not there. Why is it not there? Because they don't believe in it. And I said, well, if I don't believe in the sharks, does that mean they're not there? They said, yes. If I close my eyes, God won't punish me. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. Third reason is because God is clearly known. God is not hidden away in some mystery that's hard to find. God is open and public. God is clearly known. The Bible puts it in several different ways. Firstly, in creation. The second quotation there is, of course, the beginning of the very Bible. A fundamental statement of what the Bible is about is found in the opening chapter, that is, that God created the heavens and the earth. He is over and above it, he's outside it, and he's made every part of it, including you and me. It is his world, it is his universe. He has made it. Notice then the fourth quotation there, it's a little longer, we'll read it. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. God's character is seen in creation. God's nature, his existence, is known by creation, by seeing it. Now, don't ask me to give you traditional proofs for the existence of God. The Bible never gives those things. I don't give those things. They're philosophers' playthings. They don't prove anything one way or another, except that you may be able to pass your examinations. God in creation, though, is well known and recognised. People throughout the world have known that God is there because of creation. And we did a survey of 1,000 students at the University of New South Wales. See, when you go up to them in threes and fours and say you believe in God, well, in threes and fours, atheists always hang around. But when you go up to them individually and anonymously with a survey and ask them, do you believe in God, the vast majority do. That's why I know you do too. And when you ask them the reason why, they always give you the same reason why. Because of the world around about them. Because of the very creation. And that's what the Bible says is the case, that people will always be convinced that you cannot really believe in this world has just happened. That life has just happened. Mr. Monod does. Mr. Monod will put it. Come to me afterwards. We'll be down talking there. Mr. Monod puts it to us that it's all a matter of chance. That's all that happened. Just popped out one day. You and I. And most people find that unbelievable. The probabilities involved, of course, are massive that you and I just popped out. Massive. The chance is so unlikely, even given Mr. Monod's method of doing it with DNA molecules and the rest. The chance is astronomically small that we could ever happen. And yet, there's not one in 20 probabilities, there's one into the 10 billions probabilities. Yet, we're firmly convinced that it all just happens. See, most people can't come at that. But it's not only God reveals himself in creation, he reveals himself in history. Look here in number three of the quotations there. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. You see, God has spoken in history, firstly through the people of Israel. Very weird, very strange history is the history of the people of Israel, isn't it? Small nation, ancient nation. They were nobody. They were never anybody. They were always poor, always weak, always being ruled over by other nations, always being beaten in warfare and so on. They were a nothing of the ancient world, and yet they're the only group in the ancient world that are still going. That's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? Not only that, but their prophets predicted that that's what would be the case. The Edomites, haven't met an Edomite lately, have you? Have you met a Moabite lately, or an Ammonite, an Amorite, Girgashite? No, none of those around. Philistines? Well, there are lots of Philistines, so they're another game. But you haven't met any of these people, have you? And the Old Testament says you wouldn't. The prophet said you wouldn't. The prophet said the only ones that'll stay on are the Egyptians, but they'll be a second-rate power from here on in. I have met Egyptians. Have you met Egyptians? That's extraordinary, isn't it? The prophets of Israel actually tell you things. They say they are speaking from God. Have you checked out the prophets of Israel? And even more so, have you checked out the Son of God? For he comes, notice what it says there, in these last days, he has spoken to us, in third quote there, by his Son. The person of Jesus is God speaking to mankind. He lived at a specific time, in a specific place that you can check out by public information. Go to the library and read up about him, the historical documents that are available about him. Weigh them up. It's all happened in public. He preached in front of thousands. He died by public execution. He was seen by hundreds after he had died to have risen from the dead. Jesus went about doing good, doing the very things that the Israelites would expect God to do. Because that is who Jesus claims to be. God does not live in secret, in mystery. God reveals himself in what he has made and in the history of his people, and in particular in coming to earth as a man. He reveals himself. God is not hidden, and that is why the vast majority of mankind are theistic, not atheistic. Very, very few people in history have ever been atheistic. Because the evidence around about screams the other. Well, you say, well, if the evidence screams around, why are there any who deny it? How can they deny the evidence if it's all so clear, Philip? Which brings me to the fourth reason. Because atheists are stupid because they are great ones for censoring information. That is the reason. It's a great reason, a censorship of information. You see, it said there, Paul says it back in Romans 1, the fourth of the quotation, since what may be known, right down the bottom of the left-hand page, about God is plain to them because God has made it plain. Sorry, that's the first sentence I want. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, power and nature have been clearly seen, being understood by what was made, so that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. The morality suppresses the truth. They use the mind to run away from God and claim to be wise, but demonstrate themselves in foolishness. You say, look, this is a bit rough. I know atheists, and they're very reasonable people. They'll discuss the matter at great length. They're interested in talking through the ideas and reasoning. They're open and they're free to discuss and inquire. Now, I say to your friends, if you know that type of person, or if you're that kind of person, that's more like the soft agnostic. And I hope you are like that one, because I've got a great challenge for you to prove that you are like that one in a little while. But that is not what they're like at all. That's not what they're like. You see, they will not discuss the possibilities of God. The probabilities that Mr. Monod wants to put forward, sorry, I got those other names involved, Mr. Monod wants to put forward, the probabilities are way out of tune. See, there are people who are not Christians. Here's an article from Nature I have here, written back in 1969, about the probabilities involved in this kind of genetic idea that you and I have popped out of the primeval sludge. The probabilities involved, the mathematics of it is worked out in this article. You might like to check it out, volume 224, October 25, 1969. The conclusion, volume 224, 1969, look it up. The conclusion the man comes to is that we cannot make sense of it. It's totally improbable and unlikely. And so what do we do about it? He says, well, there is another alternative. There is the alternative of special creation or a directed evolution. There are possibilities that are open to Christians. Maybe this man's a Christian. Not in your life, he's not. He said such a problem is beyond the scope of our investigation, so we need to ignore that and get back to what we can think about. Check it out, page 343. You see, they will not face up to it. They will not face up to their view as a totally improbable view. Mr. Crick, Mr. Hoyle, I understand Mr. Crick, I'm having trouble tracing this down. Some of you may be able to help me out. But Mr. Hoyle, of course, the famous one, he's now convinced that the probabilities are all against that kind of spontaneous combustion. And so now what he's after are beings from outer space that have sent all kinds of bacteria down into the earth. See, anything is more believable than God. Anything is more believable than God. Why? They're open, they're free. Well, will they look at the evidence of Jesus Christ? Will they investigate what Jesus and the history of Jesus? No. Our 1,000 student survey showed us less than 20% had ever read the New Testament. The evidence is there, but people close their eyes to the evidence. And they say, I don't know, but I'm willing to find out, but I just can't be bothered reading the book. Willing to find out? Really want to find out? Really open to inquire on a subject as fundamental, as important as the existence of God? But not really to look at the book? Here's the book. Good news, free, absolutely free. You don't want to read that much? John's Gospel, free. Give it to you even a smaller version, well, that's just as long. Free. Just outside, you'll find a bookstall. They're all there. They're all free for you. Here's a little book, What is a Christian? Free for you. The information is freely available. Read it. Inquire. Find out. But I suggest to you people are not interested in finding out. Preaching to the converted, you've at least come. Or again, you say, what about in lecture class? You ever drop God into a tutorial class? I've been a Christian long enough to have tried it. I tell you, the air gets icier than you see outside today. You drop God. I mean, we're going to discuss the ills of society, the history of mankind, but we'll leave God out. Because that's what happens at this university, doesn't it? God is a subject that is not allowed to be brought into the lecture class. He is not allowed to be brought. But you say, but you can do it in philosophy of religion. Well, I've done philosophy of religion courses. I haven't done one here, so have they still got one here? Anyway, I've done them on all kinds of campuses, all kinds of situations, philosophy of religion. And of course, it's never the philosophy of religion, it's always the philosophy of irreligion. It never comes closely to the philosophy of religion. They do not know what it is about. That is here it is. Here's the textbooks. You see, the last time I did a philosophy of religion course, textbook on body, mind and death. It's all about whether there's immortality and like that. It just doesn't mention Jesus or the resurrection. But of course, it's a philosophy of Christian religion. That's what they're talking about, the Judaic Christian God. What about the one on the existence of God by John Hick? These were the textbooks I was given. Here's a discussion on the existence of God. It just doesn't mention Jesus, who happens to be God. It's a small detail that's left out, but we're going to analyse the Judaic Christian God without mentioning him by name. Of course, you can't mention him by name because no one wants to deny the existence of Jesus. And once you've got the existence of Jesus, then you've got a whole big problem. Here's another one. This was the textbook the last time I did it also, Philosophy of Religion, Essays by Basil Mitchell. Again, a whole lot about the existence of God, but nothing about Jesus. I was taught about the basic God. That was the last lecture I heard on the subject. Basic God. I've never met anybody who believes in basic God, and it was a tremendous relief to me when the lecturer was able to prove that he didn't exist. Never seen Christians so happy. Fourth reason, then, is the censoring of information. The fifth reason for viewing atheism as stupid has got to do with the consequences of atheism. Where does it lead to? This is the argument from the reduction to the absurd. But the absurd is massively absurd. First of all, the theatre of the absurd. That, of course, is atheism. That's where it's about, isn't it? They have understood that when you do away with God, then the world can only be viewed as mad. It's what Nietzsche's about. It's what he's writing about. That's what the existentialist writings of Sartre and Camus point out. Life is utterly, completely meaningless and absurd. That is the statement. And absurd it comes across. It's absurd for some, of course, because they know the deceit. There are many more practical atheists than real atheists, the theoretical atheists. Many of you, I'm sure, are practical atheists. I believe God's there, but I don't have anything to do with him. Right? That's the practical atheist. That's the shut your eyes type of the Psalm 14. But that kind of deceit is only the beginning. You see, meaninglessness is what captures up once you start to the theoretical atheism. Look at the fifth quote there. Here's the quote from the Old Testament atheist. Ecclesiastes wrestles with the issue of take God away. And what do you get? And the answer? Meaninglessness. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Book of Ecclesiastes. I tell you, it comes straight out of the theatre of the absurd and modern literature. You'd never know it's an ancient book if I read it to you. The ideas as old as that. You don't have to go to Nietzsche. Go back to the Bible. The answers are all there. They're already wrestled with long, long ago. Do read it. Meaninglessness is the result. You see, if everything just happens, if life is just as this man wants it to be, chance and necessity, that is, matter is always there, and by chance a spark flew off, and now because of the DNA molecules, it just keeps on repeating itself over and over again. If that's all you are, that's all I am, part of the primordial sludge that's kind of just popped out by accident this way, then we're here because we're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. There's no reason, is there? There's no purpose in life. There's no aim. And there are no values. There's no true and false. There's no good. There's no love. There's just existence. We're just what we are because we are because we are because we are. Now, is that what you think you are? Just what you are because you are? You see, what I am and what this lectern is exactly the same. I've happened to have this particular model that kind of creates this kind of flesh, etc. It has this kind that creates this kind of flesh. But we're exactly fundamentally the same. We're just parts of the primordial sludge. Now, of course, it's superior to me because it is not under the misapprehension that it's a someone. You see, I am terribly disordered grey matter. I actually have got this matter twitching around inside my head which keeps telling me that I'm a person, which of course is a nonsense. I'm just sludge. Now, if you can believe that you are sludge, doesn't matter because you're just sludge. I suggest to you that once you move to removing God, which 19th century man does, then what you then find out is that you remove man as well. The person disappears. They're no longer there. And the world is utter madness, as Nietzsche found out. Although, of course, you don't believe him because he was mad, wasn't he? They locked him up. Or was he? You see, there is your great problem, isn't it? You remove God and you cannot have all the things that go with him. But it's worse than that. You see, the consequences are more than that. Can be worse, yes. Of course, there's an appointment that everybody's going to keep. An appointment that dominates existentialist writing and atheistic writing. Because once you take God out, there is still one absolute left, isn't there? It's death. That becomes the absolute that then dominates your living. That is the only purpose for which you're living. That is the only aim and goal and direction in life now, is the grave, is the cemetery plot. We'll talk about it on Friday. Do come, we're going to talk about the whole subject of death. Because you remove God, death is all that you've got left. And so they all play with the subject of death. Look at the last of the quotations there. Just as man is destined to die once and after that to face judgment, there it is. There's the destiny of us all, death. Is that all life is about? Filling up coffins? Occupying little niches in cemetery, in crematorium walls? Is that all life is about? This passage is worse. Just as man is destined to die once, after that he is to face the judgment. You see, here is the great folly of atheism. What do you do then when you're face to face with God in your judgment? What do you say then to him? Oh, fancy. You are there after all. Well, that's lovely, isn't it? Yes, well, I always suspected deep down you were. I mean, remember that time I had a chat to you? You know, when I was caught in the surf and being jumped around. I talked to you then, didn't I? Yes, and remember that other time down in the foxhole? Yes, I talked to you there too. There are no atheists in foxholes. No. Yes, I'm sure you remember. Yes, well, no, I do remember I made that promise about turning back to you, but, well, my memory's not too good. But still, what are you going to say to God? It was a nice theory. I enjoyed the idea. It got me through philosophy of religion class. What are you going to say to God when you meet him face to face? But that brings me to the sixth and the greatest of all the follies. The atheist misses out on a rescue operation. You see, the atheist is so keen in his hatred of God that he always paints God in the most harsh, terrible, terrifying, ridiculous characteristic that is possible. They always paint him as the fault-finding wowser, as the big policeman in the sky going around trying to pick on people. We'll talk about the problem of evil. We do that on Thursday at lunchtime. And the whole attitude that people have towards God, who do not want God. But the trouble with this whole thing is that they miss out on the character of God in all his love and mercy and generosity. For although we've spurned God all our lives, although we've turned our back on him, although we've told him to rack out of our lives, we don't want to have anything to do with him, yet what has he done? Look at this last quotation. It says, just as it was destined man to die once and after that to face the judgment, so Christ was sacrificed once to take away the sins of many people. And he'll appear a second time, not to bear sins, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. God so loved us and is concerned for us that he took our judgment upon himself in the person of his Son. That's what his Son comes to this world to do. Not just to show us that God is there and what he is like, although he does do that, but his Son comes to this world, to our existence, to us as humanity. He comes to be a person to take the punishment for us, so that when we die and face the judgment, we need not find ourselves lost, but forgiven and pardoned. But of course the atheist is so keen to deny God and to turn his back on God that the greatest folly of all, he misses out on the pardon that God has already won for him at the cost of his own Son. What a folly. What a double folly. To cause yourself to be brought into judgment in the first place and then to miss out on the pardon that the judge has won for you. There is a great folly. Why have I brought it all out? Because atheism is enormously attractive to us all. We don't want God. We don't want anyone running our lives. We want to do our own thing. And as long as we want that, we don't want God. And so what we will do all the time is look to the atheist to give us the wisdom, to give us the rationalization by which we can get out of God. And one of the best ways of doing that, of course, is to hear what they have to say. And when you hear what they have to say, you say, well, you can't prove atheism, so I'll just stay agnostic. In other words, my back away from God, my back turned to God, I'll hope that there is something down the atheistic track, and I tell you all that is down there is utter stupidity. That is what is down there. You're going to believe a negative, which you can't do. The hardcore agnostic, it's the same kind of deal. So you say, well, look, I'm just a softcore agnostic. I don't know. You don't know about God, about the very purpose of living? You don't know? Well, why not find out? Two challenges I have today. One is to those who don't know and who are genuinely soft agnostics, who want to find out, willing to face up to evidence and be persuaded or dissuaded. Well, we're giving away books, free of charge outside. There's one that's for sale here by John Chapman. It's just, what, $3? It's dirt cheap. Buy a couple myself, actually, and give away to other people. Dirt cheap, just outside there. You say you just don't know? Well, there is the opportunity of finding out, isn't it? Do take the opportunity as it comes before you. I suggest to you that the attractiveness of atheism will come deep in your heart at this moment. And you'll want to say, yeah, but I don't really want to find out. And that is the truth. That is the truth that the Bible says, and so I should actually testify to you that maybe they've got something here. And you'll know the reason why. Of course, you don't want to change. But there's a second group of people I want to talk to very briefly for a moment now. And they'll be here. There are a group of people who know it's true. Known it's true for years, possibly, or known it's true just in the last few minutes. They know that their real problem is they want to run their own life their own way. They know God's there. They know Jesus is God. They know that he died for them. They don't have to do any investigation. It's not lack of information that's keeping them away from God. It's their own self-will that is keeping them away from God. And they know they need to put that right. Now, what do you have to do? What do you have to do to become a Christian, to get right with God? If you just keep the card with you, but turn over the back here of this sheet, you'll see there's a prayer there. Because what you've got to do is pray to God. And I'm going to lead in that prayer in a moment. Yeah, in a lecture theatre, I'm going to pray. If you can pray under the trees, you can pray in a lecture theatre. I'm going to pray out loud this prayer. And it's the kind of prayer you need to pray if you want to get right with God. And I'm going to invite you to pray that prayer with me, just quietly in your own mind, to God. If you know that it's true, and you know you need to make the change. Because in the end, it's not an intellectual plaything. It's a personal moral decision that you need to make. And if you're at that state in life already, then I want you to pray this with me in your own mind, in your own heart. Let's just look at the words first. I'll read them. I know I'm not worthy to be called a child of God. I don't deserve the gift of eternal life, and I'm guilty of rebelling at you and ignoring you. So that's what agnosticism's about and atheism's about. I need forgiveness. And then thank you for sending your son to die for me, because that's what he does. Died that we may not be punished, that I may be forgiven. Thank you that you raised Jesus to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Now, friend, words are cheap. Even words that are being said in your own head are cheap. There's no point saying words if you don't mean them when you're speaking to God. And if you mean them, I'm going to invite you also to make contact with us so that we can help you. You'll need lots of help, someone who wants to make that change. And so I'm going to invite you. But I wanted to tell you that before I actually got to say the prayer, because there's no tricks in this business, no point of tricking anybody. If you're going to pray this prayer with me, I'm going to invite you also to contact with me, and I'll tell you about how to do that in a second. Let's just stop, and if you can, if you wish to bow, I mean, I'm a great bower in praying, you don't have to. Let's just stop and think about it. And then if you want to pray this prayer with me, then you pray it along in your own head to God. I know I'm not worthy to be called a child of God. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I'm guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you. I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your son to die for me that I may be forgiven. Thank you that you raised Jesus to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my Lord and Master. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.